Welcome back to the Inclusive Activism Podcast. This is going to be part two of my interview with Luke Black. I'm guessing that's going to be roughly a four-part series. It could be a three-part series, so I'm just kind of recording a few intros and outros as far as trying to find some ways to gently blend things together. So we're still finding our feet here between myself and my producer, Sarah. Although I really loved this conversation, I love the fact that we got to talk about so many different things. Luke is a very real person. Well, with that, we'll go ahead and get right into what we talk about with part two with the interview with Luke Black.
For the past few months, Luke was up at Standing Rock. The first question I think I had for him was, tell me about what the community was like. The other thing too is like, I mean, this is a really, really poor analogy, so bear with me here, but whenever I go camping, I find it's the camping trips that, like, suck that are really the best camping trips, right? Like, when it rained,
right,
where you couldn't get the fire started, where you ate the raw marshmallows and you're, like, trying to, like, breathe on the chocolate to get it smelled.
Right.
You know, it's not the best camping trip that you remember. It's the worst camping trip I remember. And not that this is the worst camping trip, but more so that you're in a space, right? It's cold. People are kind of starting to leave. You know, things are kind of dim and difficult, grim and difficult when you're there, because like you're looking at the long, hard, brutal North Dakota winter, and how are you going to be there and stay there? And you know, the folks looking to build the pipeline are like, yeah, we're fine, we've got food, we're warm, we're good, we've got heavy machinery. And you came at a really dark and difficult time, so kind of just, you know, tell me the story about like getting there, what it was like.
Yeah, Standing Rock, I think for me, I had been watching what was happening at Standing Rock really from a distance. I had had a good friend that had gone up in September for a couple of days and had come back and had unpacked some stuff with me about what was happening there, and had unpacked a lot about the orientation of Standing Rock. But to be honest, like, my participation in Standing Rock actually began on the other side of the globe. So in April and May of this year, I went over to Palestine to do some human rights violation monitoring work with a human rights organization. And essentially what we were doing was monitoring interactions between the Israeli occupying forces and Palestinians, and also monitoring the interaction of settlers, Israeli settlers with Palestinians in Hebron. And you know, why I bring that up is because both of these stories ultimately are stories about colonization, settler colonization to be specific. And when we look at what is happening in Palestine, I mean, we have Israel, which is a colonial state that is occupying through violence, through settler colonialism, land that that belongs to Palestinians. And why this becomes important is because as a white American, my roots and how I've come to have a lot of the privileges that I have are rooted in settler colonialism. I mean, it is the story of America, of the United States specifically. Settler colonialism is our history. And so to go to Palestine and to spend time in both Palestine and Israel, for me was an opportunity to learn about settler colonialism, learn about what it looks like in its current form, and ultimately to begin to do the work, to do work against settler colonialism. And part of what came out of my time in Palestine is that as a person who has benefited from settler colonialism, I have an obligation to work against it. And that means that I have to maintain one foot in places where I see settler colonialism happening globally, because there is are direct connections between U.S. settler colonialism and Israeli settler colonialism, I need to maintain a foot in that world, and I need to be doing work against settler colonialism that I see at the global level, but I also need to be doing work against settler colonialism that is happening right now, right here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so Standing Rock came about for me as an opportunity for me to do work against settler colonialism here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And we have to view Standing Rock as settler colonialism. We can't separate out the environmental nature of Standing Rock from what was actually happening. And that temptation is always there to say, oh, this is about water, ultimately.
The lens of whiteness.
Right.
If it was about water,
it is. It is.
It wouldn't be there at all.
It is, right? And yes, when you were at Standing Rock, you know, we talk about water is life, and we sing songs, and, you know, we are working around the water. But to root that as an environmental issue ultimately is to ignore the settler colonialism that is inherent in that. And the aspect specifically that I'm talking about is one of the principles of settler colonialism ultimately is genocide. It's ultimately how do we destroy a group of people for the purposes of taking their land and their resources. And that is a model that is played out across the US, across Canada, and plays out in global colonialism.
Well, and I think too, when you talk about genocide specifically, one of the untalked about parts of that is making someone assimilate into a culture
sure.
is also genocide.
Sure.
When, you know, I think there's a deep connection to the thought that, like, you have to be killing someone for genocide to happen. What happened in boarding schools was genocide.
Yes.
Because you're taking the culture away
yes.
from someone. So, you know, just so to widen the definition in case folks
yes.
don't, but
yes.
It's just another way of, like, looking and seeing genocide. But I'll let you continue.
Right, and even, like, the way that we devalue our blood, right? Even
mm-hmm.
even how we devalue who our ancestors were and all of that, yes, is deeply rooted in genocide. But when we look at Standing Rock specifically, so what doesn't get talked about very much is that the water issue, right, that pipeline was originally supposed to be built north of Bismarck.
Yeah.
And it was going to cross the water supplies for the city of Bismarck. Now, Bismarck is a city that is 92% white.
Yeah.
And the residents in the city council in Bismarck voted and fought against the placement of the pipeline across their water supplies because it was deemed too dangerous for their water supplies. So they voted to have it moved, right? And it was moved specifically to cross the water supply of the Standing Rock Sioux. So in that moment, the lives of the Standing Rock Sioux were deemed as less valuable than the 92% white community of Bismarck. So we look at this and we have to say that the citizens of Bismarck willingly chose to advocate for that pipeline to be placed in a spot where if it did leak, the people that would be harmed, the lives that would be lost, the environment that would be impacted would be indigenous land, right? That is an attribute of settler colonialism.
Well, and I think people miss. In that fight at Bismarck, the answer to the question was no DAPL, right? It's not
right.
reroute DAPL.
Right.
It's no DAPL.
It's no DAPL.
And
it's,
so had they
yes.
just gone, like, with their privilege in that moment to say, you know, don't put not just not here, because I mean that's I think what you see right most of the time. It's not just not at all, it's not here, not my backyard,
right
like
right.
I don't want wind turbines in my backyard, they're an eyesore. I'd love wind
right.
turbines in my backyard, but you know it's always not me, it's somewhere else. Just
right.
say no
right
in general
right and even how we say not in my backyard and then how we enforce not in my backyard ultimately then it becomes another characteristic of settler colonialism. And this is where we'll get to the story about right Thanksgiving,
yeah.
right? Is that one of the attributes of settler colonialism is the intentional grounding of theft of land, destruction of people by the violent application of force by the state. So when you look at the history of the U.S., right, it was the U.S. Army. It was, you know, it was the recruitment of volunteer rangers all throughout the Western United States. You know, it was the application of state-sponsored violence that ultimately allowed the United States government to take land from indigenous people. You see it in Israel, where you have the Israeli state, the military, enforcing and allowing settlers to occupy, you know, Palestinian land. And so when we go to Standing Rock now, what we see is that we have Morton County Sheriff, we've got Bismarck Police Department, we've got law enforcement agencies sending individuals from across multiple states to participate in that. We've got the participation of the National Guard. We've got all of these state-sponsored agents of violence that are asked to then go enforce the destruction of indigenous land and ultimately, you know, enforce what may be the destruction of his indigenous lives. And so what you see is that the state, in the form of the police and in the form of the sheriff's department, is asked to ultimately go defend this process, which places law enforcement in direct confrontation with water protectors, with folks like myself, you know, as an ally who was there standing in solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux and the indigenous communities that were there. And that plays out in, you know, unfortunately plays out in very violent terms. And because that, you know, because Standing Rock is it's away from Bismarck, you know, it's about an hour away from Bismarck, and, you know, there's one cell phone tower down there, and, you know, because it's isolated, what the state gets to do becomes questionable at best. And so, you know, for those that are listening and had an opportunity to watch what happened in, I think it was somewhere on like November 24th. I'm not really sure the exact day.
Talking about the water
cannons. Yeah, the what has essentially become like legendary for these water cannons. You know, it was a Sunday evening, and you know, the Morton County Sheriff Department had closed the main road that leads down into the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. And you know, there were some vehicles on the bridge that at one point had been burned, and the sheriff's department had chosen not to remove these vehicles and had moved them in such a way that they were a blockade. And they were using these burnt out vehicles as an excuse to maintain the closure of the road. At one point, the elders in the youth council or whoever was in charge at that point decided that we were going to move those vehicles out of the way to remove the excuse that law enforcement was using to continue to close the road. And so they had brought in a semi and they were able to drag one of those vehicles out of the way. And in that process, they asked whoever was in the camp to come up to the bridge and participate in this act of resistance. So the call went out about 6 p.m. that night for anybody that was able-bodied and willing to go to the bridge to go. And this,
oh, you gotta add in,
yeah, this, so yeah, so yeah. Right,
I didn't know if you're gonna have
right a yeah. Clear, yeah, a clear ask,
yeah,
right, a clear ask for anybody who had come to camp under the auspice of standing in solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux. You know, dinner was about to happen, you know, when this ask went out, and I was in the kitchen with the camp that I was at, and
Volunteering in the kitchen.
Yeah, I had been volunteering with this kitchen, and you know, we were getting ready to serve dinner, and one of our elders had come in and made the ask that they were asking for anybody who was able-bodied and willing to go up to the front lines to go up to the front lines. And you know, the Standing Rock Sioux and the camp elders made no qualms and held back in no way about telling people when they arrived in camp that they were there to stand in solidarity, and that if they were there, they should understand that at any point they may be asked to participate in direct actions and may be asked to be arrested right? And so the grounding of that was always present. And,
well, not just arrested, arrested, beaten, hurt.
Sure, you know, sure. Right? With any, rubber bullets. Anything, yeah. You know, anytime you're asked to participate in that situation. And so the elder comes in and asks us, and so I get my coat and gloves, and because it's about 25 degrees out at this point, and I go up to the main room, you know, the main tent, where everybody is sort of gathering and waiting for dinner to be served. And I go in there, and there's probably like 50 folks in there, predominantly white folks. And I just say, the elders have announced that there's an action happening at the bridge right now, and they're asking anybody who is able-bodied to go up to the front lines. And I ask, and crickets, right? Yeah. Just crickets. Yeah. You know, it's...
Well, and two, so you know. Because it's so easy to think, yeah, I'm just me doing my regular thing, right? But I think that's the reason why I wanted to make sure I had you on here. You know, you're a special person. Like, that wasn't the general reaction. Wasn't like, yeah, let's go do that. You didn't just go, let's go do that. You're like, hey, let's go do that. Yeah. And unfortunately, you got the crickets. But, I mean, there's not a lot of people that would do the let's go do that. And that's part of the reason why, you know, I know, again, it's easy to think I'm just a regular old policeman doing my thing.
Right.
That action and your choice to do that action is special and unique.
Well... Yes, I mean, we can't, let's not dismiss the fact that, yes, like, I have training in this, like, I've chosen to do this work, and mm-hmm. I've done this work all over the world, right? Let's not dismiss that reality, obviously. Yeah. But let's also not dismiss that question from the question that is going to be asked of all of us who want to do this work, who are interested in understanding what it is to work against power and privilege, to work against oppression, because that question, the question of will you go to the front lines, is now the question before everyone, right? In the age of Trump, right? In the rise of fascism, where the hidden nature of oppression and the hidden nature of racism has now been moved back, and there is such blatant attempts to grab power and oppress folks. That question of, will you do this? Will you take a stand? Is now before all of us. And if I'm honest, if you want to do this work, you got to ask yourself that question. Mm-hmm. And you got to get up in the morning and you got to say, if the call goes out today, am I going to step up? Because the call is perpetual now. And if you want to do this work, if you want to be in community, if you want to build trust, you got to show up and you got to participate. To not show up and to not participate in this moment, in such an obvious moment as this, is really to fall back and to continue to benefit from the power and privilege that we have been given. Mm-hmm. That's just being real about where we're at. So going back to Standing Rock, so I go and I ask this question and there's crickets and I'm disappointed, but that's okay. I mean, I'm not gonna like spend the rest of my evening being disappointed that all of these folks who had an opportunity to go to the front lines didn't. I'm going to set that aside. I'm going to go to the front lines. And so myself and my friend, who herself is a woman of color who has come to the United States and is doing work here in the United States. So her and I go up to the front lines together, and, you know, we come over the hill. You know, it's about a half a mile walk to get from our camp to the bridge. And, you know, as we're going, there's obviously stuff happening. We're seeing, you know, people, like, we're seeing, like, folks being rushed back into camp to where the medics are. And you obviously see the lights. You can hear the helicopters and the drones. And you can hear the planes, the news choppers flying overhead. And you get up and you go over the hill and you look down into the valley where the bridge is. And the bridge is full of people. And you can see, like, the landscape that is before you is this slim two-lane bridge, and there's 1,000 people on this bridge, and then there's a wall of lights and barbed wire and police. And those police are all dressed in riot gear. They're wearing gas masks. They're all heavily armed. And they're standing behind razor wire, a wall of razor wire. Right in the middle is this big truck that has a water cannon on it. And you're, as we come over the hill, you see that the water cannon is just, it's on. And it's spraying the folks that are on the bridge. You know, the water cannon can reach probably about 60 feet in its direction, and it's just spraying down everybody that's in within 60 feet. And as I said, like, it's 25 degrees out and it's night and the temperature is dropping. Yeah. You know, the river below the bridge is frozen over, but yet there's 1,000 people on the bridge. And so, you know, we make our way onto the bridge and we get about 40 feet up. We're about close enough that the water cannon would pass us and we'd get the mist from the water cannon, but we're not close enough that we're in its direct line. And, you know, we're up there and you can, you begin to start to make out the police and you begin to start to see the interactions that they're having. And, you know, everything from this point on, we have to remember that the police are standing behind a wall of razor wire that they've put up, right? Nobody's going across that wall, right? And nobody's going across that wall unless they really want to get cut up. And so any questions about engagement between those who are on the bridge and law enforcement needs to be framed in the context of, like, violence, the myth of violence that the protectors are bringing. You can't dismiss that, like, it would have, one, been illogical for the protectors to be rushing razor wire. And so you have to dismiss that, and then you have to talk about why is it convenient for law enforcement to continue to have this narrative about protectors as violence, and how does that allow them to hide their actions and to justify their actions? And so what we see is we see this group on the bridge, and the front line is made up of folks that have these, essentially they're like these shields that they've made. They're like big 10-foot shields that they've made out of sheets of plastic, metal, like laminate roofing. And, you know, there's a whole wall of folks that are up at the front with these shields on, trying to shield the protectors, the water protectors, from this cannon, of this water cannon that is blasting them. But they're obviously not able to shield everybody, and so lots of folks are getting sprayed down. And, you know, people just continue to chant. They continue to chant. They continue to demand, you know, justice, and, you know, they continue to do chants. And one of the most powerful chants that always continues to resonate in this space is this chant of, who do you protect, who do you serve? Right, which is a question that is always asked of law enforcement in this space, where, who are you protecting here? You're not protecting the people. You're protecting the investment of a corporation. Yeah. And who are you serving? And because it's not the people that they're serving. They're not protecting anyone.
Right.
There's no other group of people whose lives are at risk that law enforcement is there to protect. They're there to protect the investment that stock owners have in the destruction of a water supply. And so this call is always going out, and, you know, the police are continuing to spray people down. And, you know, as we're making our way into the crowd, you know, you can hear rubber bullets flying in the air, right? And you can hear, you know, there were lots of officers that had, you know, shotguns that had been set up to shoot beanbag rounds, and there are lots of officers that are up on that line that had paintball guns, and you can just hear this stuff. You can hear it in the air, right? And you're in this crowd, and every once in a while, somebody next to you would get hit with a paintball, or, you know, would get hit with a rubber bullet, and so you're seeing this stuff flying. And we'd been on the bridge for probably about 10 minutes or so, and that's when the first round of tear gas that we were involved in was set out. And so police would shoot tear gas into the crowds. You know, for the rounds that get thrown, like, you could watch the arc, right? You could watch them toss it in the arc, and you'd be able to get out of the way. But for the rounds of tear gas that get shot, right? Those things are moving fast,
yeah.
Right? And there's no way to get out of it. And so, like, shooting a round of tear gas into a crowd, people are just taking it. They're just getting hit with tear gas. And then that tear gas would fall, and then, like, the cloud of tear gas would rise, and, you know, everybody would start breathing it in and coughing, and we would have a hard time breathing, and their eyes would be watering. And we'd move off the bridge, and then we'd, you know, catch our breath, and we'd move back. And this process went on and for four rounds of tear gas. And people would leave the bridge, and then they'd surge back. And it was really just clear that we weren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, then police would start throwing, you know, concussion bombs or, you know, sound bombs into the middle of the crowd. And, you know, that just becomes dangerous because those are big explosions that are meant to confuse folks and, you know, shock folks off the bridge. And when you're throwing them into a crowd that is 1,000 people densely packed under the bridge, it's inevitable that somebody is going to take a blast. Right. And,
yeah.
And so this went on and for a while, and, you know, ultimately it went on until about 4 o'clock the next morning. But I had left and gone back to camp and gotten some more folks, and we had come back. And when we came back, there were protesters that had, like, moved off the bridge and were on the bank of the river on the police side. And mind you, to paint the picture, there's about 25 feet of beach between that's on the protector side of this razor wire wall, and they're protesting and interacting with the law enforcement agents on the other side of the barbed wire fence on the beach. And some of the protectors about 200 feet away from the bridge had built this big bonfire, and they were sliding driftwood across the river to keep the fire going. And the fire, you know, folks that were getting sprayed with the water cannon on the bridge were coming down and going to the fire to get warm. And after about, you know, an hour of this fire going, like, you could tell that there was a conscious decision made by the water cannon, the officers that were shooting the water cannon, to try to extinguish this fire. And they tried to shoot off the bridge, but the water wouldn't reach the fire. And so what they did was they rolled out a hose. They rolled out a water hose and took this mobile hose and rolled it out 200 feet and went walking down their barbed wire wall and got to where the fire was. You know, the protectors were watching this happen. And so right about the time when the water cannon and the officers that are carrying the water cannon get down to where the fire is at, there are three water protectors that run over to the fire, and they've got these big tarps, and they get in front of the fire and they're holding up these tarps. And so there's this big bonfire that is like 3 feet behind them, and in front of them is this water cannon. And the police turn on this water cannon and try to just spray out the fire, and they just hose down these water protectors for 20 minutes. And these water protectors stand there with these tarps and they just take it. Yeah. They take this fire hydrant, you know, water blast for 20 minutes and just are just beaten up, but they hold these tarps up, and, you know, water would get through and steam would rise.
People don't even know, like, that stuff tears skin.
No, it tears skin off. Yeah. And the other thing is, like, that water cannon is pushing them back, right? So they're risking burns on the back of their legs, and, you know, those water cannons are intense. And, you know, like, water would get through and steam would rise from the fire, and, like, you know, the police officers would turn off the cannon and, like, wait to see if they'd gotten it out, and then the fire would, like, roar back to life. And every time it roared back to life, everybody on the bridge would just cheer.
Yeah.
And after about 20 minutes of doing this, the police just gave up, and, like, they turned off their water cannon and they kind of walked it back to the bridge, and the fire roared back up and people cheered. And, you know, it was this very illustrative moment of what was happening in that space, where there was no reason for the police to go after that fire.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
What is
you
that
know,
fire?
For lack of a, you know, that was just mean. That was just cruelty.
Yeah.
It
was the only space for incredibly cold people to get warm. I mean, it's not like there's, like, a warm shower down the road.
Right.
Like, this is it.
this was it. And for the police to go after that was really just indicative of the level of violence that they were willing to bring to that space. But they weren't. They were not able to defeat that fire, just like they weren't able to defeat the water protectors. Mm-hmm. And that was just a beautiful moment that really was illustrated what we were up against, but also like our ability to stand up to that and to fight that and hopefully, you know, ultimately to win.
Well, and I think that helps just because, you know, with some of the stuff they're trying to do, like I'm just going into sometimes organizations to talk about community, but it costs something.
Sure.
And it's important, but then there's something that's amazing that comes out of what you can do when you're able to be in that space. Right. And I don't think that's what people truly know and understand. What I love about your story is when you tell it is, you know, the bravery, the fact that it's just regular people that believe in something that are trying to get it to happen. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm just adding this, didn't you say like eventually the wind kind of turned on the tear gas too?
Yeah, I mean, that would happen all night.
Which I thought was hilarious.
Right, and it's always the case, wind. Right? Yeah. You can't. But yeah, I mean, like you don't want anybody to get tear gassed, right. But when the wind does turn and it blows that tear gas right back on that law enforcement agent, you're like, okay, now you're getting just a slight sensation of what we're like, what you're inflicting on us
with your equipment, like they have this mobile stuff that makes a huge difference.
And most of them are wearing, you know, tear gas. You know, most of them are wearing gas masks as well.
That notion that community costs something, but community is capable of amazing things, right? You know, even in that moment, like the fact that the community was able to like hold the bridge, the fact that the community was able to keep the fire, and then two, those images got out, right? Like, despite everybody's best efforts, like that stuff still got out, right? Because when you describe the beach, like I see the beach because I've seen the pictures of the beach. I've seen the footage of the water cannon. I've seen this stuff. And it was something that you had said when we talked about this the first time. Like, it must have been really interesting that first meeting the morning after that interaction. Because even on the faces of some of the law enforcement in that moment, right? That protect and serve, right? That's ringing in their ears. Nobody joins law enforcement to, like, throw... I mean, maybe... Okay, maybe.
Oh, there are some.
This is true.
There are some.
But I don't think the vast majority are, like, right. This is what I'm hoping for, is to spray water on people like,
sure,
25
right.
below.
Right.
I'm not here to, you know... I mean, there's some people that are making a glee at it, but then there's some people that had to see the humanity of themselves, of what they... If they didn't do, they stand by and let happen in that moment. And I think that was huge, because you're looking at a people without power, without resources, without money, with people with resources, with money, and being able to turn them away. It's amazing. But on the other side of that community thing, I wanted to, as a Native person, I always find it incredibly problematic when I'm trying to explain, you know, we still do Thanksgiving. It's not like, it's not the traditional Thanksgiving, but, you know, it's observed, it's still appreciated. I mean, yeah, there's nothing wrong about taking a second to be grateful for the things that you have. And you'd said the camp had swelled to, like, what?
Yeah, I mean, there was about 3,000 people regularly there, but then, like, during Thanksgiving, there was probably 7,000 people that were in camp.
So, and you were working at the kitchens, and so, of course, you're like, you're still going to do Thanksgiving, so...
Sure.
There's, like, how many turkeys did you say?
Yeah, we cooked about 20 turkeys. You know, in...
Which, in the oven, right?
Cause we thought we were going to cook them in the oven, and then we ended up, like, digging a big pit. And tried to cook them like in a pit oven, and that didn't really work. But you know, we had to scramble to get these 20 turkeys cooked, and you know, we were like a real industrial kitchen, and people were moving around each other and chopping and, you know, frying and ducking in and out, and it was just but everybody's spirits were really good, and nobody was angry or upset, and nobody got stressed out, and you know, it was a beautiful thing. I mean, it was really, really a beautiful thing.
Well, yeah, because you're fighting to like make sure that everybody's fed, like everybody's there,
sure.
And you're like in that, doing that for that community. And it's funny, you know, because you, I remember when you told the story about digging this giant trench and burying these turkeys,
right.
And then digging them up however many hours later, and you're like, Yeah, like maybe two.
Yeah, or anything of the 20, I mean, maybe three of them were three-fourths cooked.
Right.
Right, and then some of them were only about a fourth cooked, so it was just...
And then you're breaking them open and spatchcocking them, you know, like, right, with the cooking, like, trying to get it done. But, you know, like, in that moment, nobody's worried about me because the goal of serving the wee becomes so poignant. And, like, you just lose yourself in those moments and in those spaces. You know, the communal good is the thing that becomes the thing that's of great importance. And, you know, I really feel that's why I wanted to tell the story so much, because I'm trying to make sure I'm using less ableist language. So I'm trying to, like, I use invisible instead of, like, the blind thing. But I think that experience that you had of, one, everybody fighting that force and overcoming it, but then, two, just the day-to-day, like, the, all right, we're cooking, everybody's going to act like we've all been in an industrial kitchen. And there were some, like yeah, amazing chefs that are there. Chefs, yeah. But, like, amazing chefs working with just a bunch of randos show up to North Dakota to be engaged in this moment. And I think that's the opportunity that so many people are just... It's just invisible. Like, they have no framework for what this thing is and what this stuff looks like. But then at the other point, it costs something. It does always cost something. You can't just act like you're going to pay people something, or that, like, we'll have these fairly flat rules that are flatly applied, that don't look at the individual and the individual needs. I mean, it takes time. It's difficult. That being that community takes a lot of time and effort. But when you invest in that, and that's there and that exists, I mean, shit just hums in a way that doesn't in other spaces. You know, like, I've never been to McDonald's where shit's just humming. You know what I mean? Like, I still get my stuff, and I still get, you know, my McDonald's level quality food, but it's not, you know, it's not the meal that you had there.
Right.
And I mean, you know, there was no, like, celebrity chef or, like, you know, Zagat Raiders, like, to test the quality of the food, but I'm willing to bet that's also one of the best meals you've ever had, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, for me, it was, this is going to sound really weird, but, like, I really like burnt stuff, right? And so I was just, like, picking at, like, turkey that had been over-fried, like, all night. It was wonderful. Wonderful, right?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, there's... So much of that space was built around people's willingness to be intentionally there to serve and to give. And that made that space so beautiful, and in a lot of ways made that space very healing, which is something that we've got to find more ways to do, is how do we create healing spaces that aren't intentionally healing spaces.
They just happen to be.
Healing proceeds from those spaces because the work that we do is life-giving.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the spaces that we need to create.
That was part two of the interview with Luke Black, and I hate to leave it on that little cliffhanger there, but there's only so many megs that we can actually upload at a time. Part of the podcast growing and needing kind of your reviews, your sharing and all those things is because this stuff takes money. The website costs money, the web space costs money, the production stuff takes money, and then any money I get from the podcast I also give to Sarah, because she's editing and doing all this stuff for free. The fact that you're willing to rate us on iTunes is huge. The fact that you are willing to share the Google Play link on your personal social media is something that makes a really big difference. Also, the notion that you might be willing to call us and talk to us makes a big difference. So please give us a call at the Inclusive Activism Hotline. The number for is 860-576-9393. Again, the Inclusive Activism Podcast Hotline is 860-576-9393. That is a great place for us to have a conversation. You can talk back. You can ask me some questions. Hit me with different scenarios about how things are working. If you want to have me cover a certain area of something that's hot in the news, or if there's an area that you'd like me to explore in the near future, I would be more than happy to analyze that. And as always, if you're interested in booking me and bringing the power of inclusive activism to your organization, you can do so at inclusiveactivism@cox.net. That's inclusiveactivismatcox.net. Or you can learn about me, Sarah, and this organization at www.inclusiveactivism.com. With that, we'll see you in a few days with part three of the interview with Luke Black.